tonight, and I'm going to make this interactive by asking some questions along the way, was my own personal view, and maybe supported by other rabbis that have made exegesis of the Bible, but generally it's my own view, and some of it, of course, is I've studied with Rabbi Chaik for many years. Some things have clearly had some osmosis, and I may be reflecting many of his ideas and not giving him full credit. So I say that in advance, that some things are clearly ideas I've gotten from him, some I may not be aware of, and some of them he may disagree with. And I suppose if you've heard many rabbis over the years already, you have an idea that not all rabbis will agree on areas, particularly philosophy and theology. Although there's generally some agreement, but there are some nuances that I'm sure. And you stop me if that's not true. Is that right, that you've had some nuances of disagreement among different rabbis that have spoken to you?
Well, yes, slight disagreements to major disagreements.
Right, right. And, you know, that's which is fine, because I'm not saying that exclusive views can be reconciled, that they're, you know, that's a modern liberal notion that everyone's right. But rather it just means that it just gives you the opportunity to sort things through on your own minds and decide which one makes the most sense and come to your own knowledge through your own exploration of these ideas in your own life. Now, what I'm particularly going to address myself to is a kind of a thematic structure to the first book of the Bible, particularly the first book of the five books of Moses, the Genesis, or Bereshit, as it's said in Hebrew, and try to look for a structure, an overlying, overarching structure to this book that explains its relevance to the other books that follow, and kind of a theme which sets the tone for, well, at least in my view, for all the Bible that follows. And basically, I think it reflects a certain philosophy of life that I think Judaism sees. Now, is an expression, I don't know if any or all of you have heard of it, going that's famous among those who learn that there are 70 faces to the Torah, and it's interpreted in different ways, but one of which is that being a book, particularly the five books of Moses, that is by Jewish tradition dictated letter for letter by God to Moses, so it's a book that reflects infinite knowledge. So when we say there are 70 faces to the Torah, it's that we can look into it in so many different aspects and find ideas behind it, because the source of all knowledge has written it and therefore can reflect this infinite knowledge, and therefore we can find many different ideas and aspects of just the same set of sentences in the Bible will teach us many ideas, and whereas a human mind might not be able to cram so much information to so small into such a document, with infinite wisdom, one can. Is everyone following me so far on that? I'm going to just stop for...
Yes. All right. We understand that.
Okay. This is a kind of as an anecdotal thing, just to fill up, give you an idea. This is something, this is my own exploration, and it may or may not be true, but it's just, I thought it was interesting. I'll share it with you. It's not the main point I'm going to address, but it's just to give you a flavor of how one can search, and it's something I don't usually do. But I, in reading recently, going over, as Jewish tradition has us every year, going through the parshios, the sections that were set up by the rabbis as different sections of the Bible that are read on mostly on Shabbos. The whole parsha is read in the shul on the Sabbath. And in looking through the first one, Bereshit, as it's called, which is the first word of the Chumash, is that I noticed in the first telling over the story of creation, the word Elo, it's usually pronounced, people refer to as Elohim, although actually the correct pronunciation is with a heem, but we can avoid saying the name of God unnecessarily, although we do that, although for educational purposes I could pronounce it, but in any case I'm used to saying Elohim. But I noticed that the word kept repeating itself in the first account. Now, many scholars have noted that in the first account, the tetragrammaton, or yud and a hey and a vav and a hey, does not appear at all. And that led them to what's referred to as higher criticism, which was first, I guess, introduced by Wellhausen, that there were different authors, reflecting from different periods of time, reflecting different philosophies that were melded together into the book over the centuries or up to a millennium, I suppose. I'm not quite sure what the most modern theory, but originally that was their idea. So the fact is that in the first account, the name of God is Yud-Heh Nevavne Heh, which is generally refers to the merciful aspect of God, is omitted. They said, well, it was a different author, and they got these two ideas, and they joined them together in a document later over the centuries. So in looking through it, I just noticed that the word Elohim, again, repeated itself so many times, so I just took a point to count it up. Now, again, this is something which is speculative, and I don't maintain it's really from heaven, so to speak, but it's just an idea I noticed, and I only give it as an example of where there may be infinite wisdom. But I noticed that it occurred many times in the first account, 35 to be exact, but what's interesting was that prior to the creation of man, it occurred 26 times. Now, that's a very kind of interesting number, because the numerical value of the name of God is also 26, referring to the name of mercy of God. Yud Nehe Nevav Nehe, that's 26 value. So, again, God... So, I was... the idea that occurred to me was that even though you do not find the mercy... until the second recounting, God's name of mercy in the story... But it occurs 26 times in the telling of the creation of the universe prior to man. Now, the idea that I conjecture, which I think may be a true idea anyway, whether or not this is meant to be taught in this passage of the Bible, is that God, as a merciful creator, is hidden in the creation. And in the first account, which is not focusing in as man is the ultimate repository of God's intent in creation, but just to describe the creation of the universe, it's the fact that God's name is mentioned 26 times prior to the creation of man is to suggest this idea that God is hidden as the merciful creator in the creation. The idea being, for instance, that there is it's hard for us to perceive, but the way the laws of the universe are ordered, it actually maximizes the benevolence to all its creatures. But sometimes we see floods and hurricanes and tornadoes and not realize that this was really the greatest kindness that God could have in the way since we don't have infinite knowledge to know how God created the universe. But with that knowledge, one would see that this was the pinnacle of mercy that in creating such a system that would still allow for free choice and the other things that are necessary to having the universe. Anyway, that's a side point, but I wanted to just mention that as being an example of that there are so many ways to look at the Bible and look at every nuance. And another example that I don't want to go into, but is that even if you can look at it yourselves in your own study groups, is to look where it's referred to. Now, in the Hebrew, it's much easier, as they refer to it as the man or man. And the naming of Eve, and whether it's called the wife or the woman or the wife, and whether the pronoun the is present or not, I thought there was significance to whether he's called the man or man. And I'll leave it for another discussion. It's for you to look at that and make your own hypothesis as to why the Bible changed that the divine writer left this in or out. But the point I want to start out with, let me ask you a rhetorical question and ask you, after the expulsion from Gan Eden, from the Garden of Eden, what would you say was the first event in human history? Or I kind of gave away my answer, but what is the first event in human history? Man's history as we know it. Any responders? David?
I don't think we have any. We'd just have to turn over there and look in the text and see. When he was driven out of the garden, then, of course, we realize the story that, the events that took place there, so I don't know exactly what you're looking for.
All right, well, as I said, it was a rhetorical, but I'm referring to really the first major event in human history. It's not such an important point. If it's the first, you could say having the child was the first event. But mm-hmm. the major story in the Bible is the story of Cain killing
Abel. Okay, there you go.
And that really begins the story of human history as we know it, because prior to that, it's really, I don't know if Rabbi Chait's given this lecture, human nature was quite different, and man's destiny would have been quite different if man had exercised his choice differently and not chosen to eat from the tree, and Chava or Eve at the same time, it also had not chosen to eat. But since man's nature was changed at that time, it became a different destiny for man and a different history, and our history really dates back from the time of the expulsion from the garden, And the first event recorded there is really a story of, in a, summarized in a word, of fratricide. Follow what I'm saying there. Brother killing brother. And I'm going to come back to what is the cause of fratricide in a minute.
All right. Well, let me ask you this in light. Why would you say that Cain reacted in that way simply because he's driven from the garden?
I didn't say that.
I know you didn't say that, but why? What caused him to act in that manner? What caused him to? And we have had some classes on this subject. That's the reason I'm asking. Mm-hmm. What caused him to kill his brother?
Right. Well, that was the point I'm going to address. What drove him? And in fact, I'll ask you the question. What I mean, I think many of you are familiar with the passage. It's just if you'll kind of search your own memories, what is your impressions as to why did Cain kill Abel?
All right, we're saying jealousy, and I would say jealousy / pride,
okay,
or egotism.
I think that's excellent, and I agree with that. And I think that's an important thing to understand. So we're going to go a little further in this class about what is the nature of jealousy, and I think it's a very essential element in understanding all of human nature. If we understand something about jealousy, we can understand something about the human nature, and we can... If you want to pontificate, I like current events. I'll talk about Hillary Clinton and how she has a problem with this issue. But we'll just go on to the Bible, and we can relate it to current events in a moment. But that's right, jealousy. And now let me, I guess I'm not quite sure how much, since I haven't really planned it out how I'm going to give this lecture, maybe we'll stop at this point and digress before I go further about the structure of the Bible. Let me make one point, and then we'll go back and talk about jealousy. I want to note that at the end of the first book, the last four sections of the four partios, which takes up almost 40% of the book, or 35% of the book, are all around one story. And that's the story of Joseph and his brothers and Jacob. Jacob going down to Egypt, the story of Joseph's enslavement, and eventual reconciliation with his brothers. And if you had to identify, I mean, if you wanted to give it a word, it's two words. The first story I call fratricide. The second story is no fratricide. And why do I give it that title? It's because the inclination for fratricide was there. The brothers were prepared to kill Joseph, and if we look at the story in its broadest outlines, they both initially refrained from the act, and eventually they became reconciled to their brothers. Now, if you would look for a cause of that resisted impulse, what was the cause of their impulse to kill their brother? Any obvious answers?
Again, we would say jealousy.
Right. That's pretty much the almost openly stated that's why the brothers they couldn't tolerate if we'd explain it psychologically. Now, the rabbis say in the Midrashim indicate they had all sorts of legalistic and altruistic motivations to explain their actions, that they understood that there was supposed to be a Jewish nation to come from the children of Jacob, and Joseph was showing traits of egotism and pride, and that they did not see how he'd be appropriate, and that they had a court of law, and they judged, and they decided that... So they all their actions had a rationalization of being done for pure motive, but the Torah does not mince its words and does not tell us all their motivations. We only see it in that they were jealous, and that presumably because of his special treatment in front of his father, and also certain egotism that they perceived on his part. And why again could they not tolerate his when we go back to Cain and Abel, we'll talk a little bit more as why they couldn't tolerate his perceived egotism, his pride, like you said, David. But again, so I'm pointing out this interesting parallelism between the first part of the story of man with Cain and Abel, and the second part of the story of man, which is with Joseph and his brothers, where they both deal with the same theme. Now, before I talk about what's the purpose of it, there's this similarity between the beginning and the end, and what's the idea of it. Let's go back to the trait that drove these two actions, which is jealousy. And maybe I'll digress again by talking a little bit about if we can understand where how jealousy enters. So I would say, I'd ask you this question, and I think it's going to address the other trait that you would notice, David, about why Cain acted as he did. But if I would ask anyone there in the audience over who's listening, why is it that, does anyone over there feel they wish they were a bird? Any hands going up?
Alright.
Because they fly, you know, that they could fly. They feel jealous of
birds.
Oh,
a bird, okay. Right.
A bird, that they wish they could fly like a bird, and they feel jealous, particularly they feel jealous of birds.
Alright, do you feel jealous of birds? There's one lady here, Barbara, that's looking a little strange, and the rest of them are saying no. Alright, no, I don't think we have no jealousy of that, no.
The consensus here is there's no jealousy of birds.
That is correct.
All right, we'll have to have Barbara come to my psychiatric office, and we'll talk about why she feels jealous of birds.
Hey, she's from New York, too, Watertown.
Oh, all right. That explains that. But generally speaking, I think most people would not put their hands up, and they're not being intimidated there because no one else did. I just think that we don't, generally speaking, walk around all day feeling like jealous of birds. Don't really give it much thought, even though they're doing something we can't do all day long, which is fly around, and presumably flying would be fun. But let me paint another scenario. Let's say, for instance, your next-door neighbor, we've gone another century forward, and your next-door neighbor has this little helicopter port in his backyard, and every time he wants to go somewhere in New York City, if he's living in or my next-door neighbor, he just tops this little helicopter. He's there in 15 minutes, he's down, and he pops in and gets in his parking space right where he works. As a matter of fact, not only do my next-door neighbor to the right, but the one to the left, and the one to the behind me, and the one in front of me, and me, I'm still doing my hour commute to work that I've been wanting to do for the last 100 years, and nothing's changed for me. But it just so happens my neighbor behind me, in front of me, to the side of me, and to the left of me are all getting there in 15 minutes or 5 minutes with a nice view along the way, and no traffic. They all, you know, they have their own their little passing lanes, they don't hit each other, whatever it is. And they're getting there nicely. Now, one might expect, or I'll ask it, would you expect that I might feel differently about not being able to fly in that instance? Or people think that I would let the feeling of jealousy crop up.
All right. What's the response from the crowd?
Oh, that'd be interesting.
All right. Now, wait a minute. We've got two responses. There would... There would probably be some envy there.
Well, I'm not so noble a soul, but I'd be seething. I don't know. I mean, I would try not to be, but so far as I'm philosophically imperfected, if everyone in my little universe was running around with helicopters...
A helicopter, you'd want one.
I certainly would want one, and not only would I want one, but more than just that I want one, because right now I don't want one. The fact is, why is it now that it's not... So why don't I just pine away that I'm not a bird, or they don't have that little helicopter flying me around?
Well, because there's no social pressure there, because no one else has one.
Right. Well, I'm going to grant that there's an element of social pressure, but I think jealousy strikes to something that besides just social pressure that's keeping up with the Joneses.
Yeah.
I'm saying is that I don't really miss so much flying per se, even though it doesn't occur to me what a convenience I'm missing too much. However, if there was a situation that would arise where everyone else could fly, even though my life would be no more inconvenient than it is right now, and I'm tolerating it quite well right now, I'm not complaining about my drive, but if it was a situation where everyone else had it, then it would be intolerable for me not to have it. And I maintain it's not because of the inconvenience of my driving. All of a sudden, I would of course, project that my complaint is why is it how unhappy it is I am driving. But since I'm doing that right now, and it doesn't bother me, I would have to say that in that situation, the reason why I'm upset has nothing to do with the fact that I can't fly there and get there in 15 minutes. I was tolerating it well, as I said before. But rather, it's something to do with the fact that they have it, and I don't. Does everyone agree with me that far?
Yes.
Right. And I can imagine, and it's hard, of course, to picture ourselves, but I'm trying to describe a fairly... useful thing that people would have that I wouldn't. It would bug the heck out of me if I didn't have it. And I maintain that the cause of that is jealousy, and that the reason is not because I'm missing the utility of the flying, but rather I don't really believe it's right that someone should have something that I don't have. And the question is, what is the source of that feeling? And I'm going to kind of take the thunder away and say, my premise is the source of that feeling is that a person's sense of his own importance, that he really believes he is the center of the universe, such that if he sees other people who lose a leg, never occurs to him, why that guy? I mean, maybe for a minute if he really feels close to him, but generally, or a million Cambodians are slaughtered, didn't get too much protest over here in this country, but he'd expect it to happen. But if some inconvenience or such happens to him, or he gets a sickness or an illness, God forbid, then he starts to say, why me? But it was just as right philosophically to ask, why them? But since the person's unstated and philosophy of which he's unaware is that he believes he is the center of the universe. And there's no man who's not exempted from that. The man who, we'll get to Moses in a minute, but the man who has the least degree I will discuss in a few moments was Moses. But that is in the core of every human heart, the belief that he is the center of the universe. Does everyone follow me on that one?
Yes. Yes, we got that.
I think that is really the core of jealousy, in that when Cain kills Hubble, he can't tolerate the fact that someone is in some fashion succeeding in a way that he expects to be his, because he assumes that he has to, in some ways, things work out for him, that he is the center of the universe. And this is the story of the beginning of the fall of the man with that idea. Adam, apparently, even after the expulsion, was so clearly aware of his place in relationship to God, he was not given over to that, but it did not take long for his own children to begin to suffer the sin, or suffer from the disease of man's, and that, of course, is part of the dual nature of man, given both the rational faculty and the part of him that's able to perceive God and his true relationship to the universe in as a creation, and also the fact that he has an instinctual self that seeks its own needs and its own gratifications, and is in conflict with what I might say is the higher aspect of man. So now I want to talk about, again, the theme of the whole first book of the Bible, or Sefer Bereishis, or Genesis, in that the book starts out with the story of the fall of man. God's creation, the handiwork of God's creation, does not live up to the free choice he's given, neither initially before the eating of the tree, and then after, once he's expelled, man begins to degenerate. And even given the free choice he has, he still he becomes preoccupied with the self and sees himself as the center of the universe, such that the jealousy, which is the source of the fratricidal impulse, emerges quickly. Now, the rest of the middle part of the first book tells one story, basically. It tells the story of the election of Abraham and his descendants to bring back the proper knowledge of man that existed prior to the expulsion from Eden. And that God, having not given up on his, not that such emotions are possible by God, but God having maintained his intent to create a creature that could perceive him and live a life with awareness of God, elected Abraham and his descendants to carry on this message and knowledge, which the essence of Judaism is really the recognition of God. That is probably the highest good and value, and that's why we speak about in Judaism is the greatest good being Kiddush Hashem, or are people familiar with that phrase? Kiddush Hashem, or sanctification of God's name?
We're familiar with the sanctification of the name of God, yes.
Right. That's in Hebrew, that's Kiddush Hashem.
Hold on just a second, please.
Yeah.
I asked you to make that statement again about Abraham being chosen to re-offer the...
Reiterate the statement that you made about Abraham...
Being the one to reintroduce...
Being the one to reintroduce...
The knowledge of man.
The knowledge to man.
Right.
Okay.
I don't know if the question asks, how do I show that, or what does that mean? But I'll assume it's a later question. What does that mean? And that it means that man, at Abraham's time and since then, has lived their lives. Human history is replete with the story of man's selfishness, the wars, and inhumanity towards each other, and but failing to live up to the divine calling and the divine and the capacity with which human beings are created to live a harmonious life with all amongst all men, and that but that is only possible in Judaism's view is if there's a relationship with God. That if God is not part, in fact, one of the names of God is actually the word Shalom or peace is the name of God, is that if God is not, so to speak, part of the equation, if man's mind is not in some way related to God, or his spiritual self is related to God, that human harmony in this planet is not possible. And that it became necessary to find a way for that knowledge to be transmitted to all of mankind. And in God's infinite wisdom, apparently he felt that a group of philosophers would just teach it to their students and on would not succeed. That it became necessary to select a family so that there would be a nation who share ideas but are also bound into that nation by birth, or by those who choose to join it, should be able to teach mankind of these ideas. Not because that all mankind need to be part of this nation, but rather that all mankind should benefit from these ideas so that eventually all mankind can live in a harmonious relationship with each other and with God. So, as I was saying, the middle section of the Bible addresses this, is the story of the election of Abraham, and then Isaac, and then Jacob, the final, so to speak, the pinnacle of the three of the forefathers, and then Jacob's children. And this nation, which is going to be created out of Abraham's descendants, is the nation which is going to redeem man from his falling after the expulsion. And it's appropriate that, and as I'm going further with my thematic explanation of the first book, it's appropriate that that nation, which is going to redeem all mankind, must redeem within itself that very trait. Because what was the trait that Cain killed Abel for? Jealousy. He could not live with his brother having a superior position to him. So too, the brothers could not become the nation that would redeem all mankind if they harbored within themselves, to at least to a significant degree, that trait. So that is why, if you look at that last four sections of the Bible, which I haven't gone into, is there's tremendous amount of providence in the story as to how it was engineered that God should bring about that the brothers and Joseph and Jacob should all recognize certain flaws in their personality and their understanding of themselves and God and their relationship, and that they should do a correction. We call it tshuva, or repentance, in a psychological and philosophical fashion, so that they could live with harmony without the jealousies that had prompted their initial fratricidal feeling towards Joseph. And that task was necessary before they could go down to Egypt and create the nation that would be born in Egypt in the next book, in Exodus, that they correct within themselves in the nucleus, in the seed that would be planted in Egypt. They had to first, God had to work it out providentially, so they should first tackle that issue. And that is I'm going to go further with it in a moment, but that was the basic thematic idea I wanted to show in the Sefer, in the book of Genesis, that the structure is to see that God had seen, that there was a falling of man away from God, sparked by this fundamental human trait of his own centrality in the universe, which reflects itself in jealousy, and that God, in creating a nation through Abraham's seed, had helped them at some level deal with this philosophical, psychological issue, and that only once they dealt with it at some level could they be prepared to become a nation that would redeem mankind of his fundamental self-importance. Because again, as I talked about the idea of sanctification of God's name, this is ultimately the task of the Jewish people, and is to bring all man to become aware of God. And therefore, becoming truly aware of God is man's unimportance. Of course, that's if one looks to the book of Job, that's the central theme of the book of Job, is the final answer that God gives to Job, is who are you?
We're going to have to change turn the tape over, please.
Okay.
Hold just a second.
So that's the thematic overview that I had wanted to lay out about the first book, but I want to talk a little bit about the second book and the idea of how the second book picks up on the first book. Now, of course, it's very interesting that in the beginning of the second book, we find the now the election of Moses and his brother Aaron. Now, there are many midrashim, or statements in the Talmud and in the other books of midrashim that talk about the true brotherhood between Aaron and Moses, and that you find that each one in this initial meeting is so concerned about the welfare of the other, which is quite appropriate that now the two leaders that are going to redeem, bring about the redemption of the Jewish people and then eventually of mankind through them, is led by people who most exemplify the idea of true brotherhood, of a selflessness, whereas in the previous we saw that that was the kind of the struggling, the core issue that kind of underlies the story of the Bible. In fact, there are many others. I'm not the first book. There are many other stories along those themes, although I'm not really addressing between Jacob and Esau and some struggle between Ishmael and half brothers of Ishmael and Isaac and such. But that and moreover. In, as I mentioned about Moses, Moses, who's the ultimate redeemer of the Jewish people, is a man who's described in the Bible as the most modest man that ever lived. In Hebrew, it's Anav Mikol Adam. He was he makes the bold statement in the Bible that no man was ever more modest. In fact, there's a story in the Talmud that discusses the greatness of Abraham, of David, Abraham, and Moses, and it says that David had said, I am a worm, Abraham makes a statement that's quoted as I'm like dust, and then it quotes Moses as having said in the Bible, which he does say, Nachnuma, what are we? We are nothing. So they say that really Moses reflected the highest philosophical perception, is that he saw himself in relationship to the infinite as nothing, whereas David had said he saw himself as the lowest of animate life. And Abraham had saw himself as the next level of not even being animate. Finally, Moses doesn't he find vis-a-vis in true perception of the source of all, he sees himself as non-existent. And that level of philosophical awareness is Moses as being the most modest. Now, of course, this trait of modesty is in direct opposite of the trait of jealousy. No one, as we discussed the idea of the planes and the travel, no one who feels himself unimportant would be bothered by the fact everyone else has all those planes. Because unless he happens to need planes and his life's inconvenient, but the fact that other people have it would make no difference to him. He's not guided because he does not consider himself to be better or such than any other people. If they have it, he shouldn't. I mean, he might not like stepping on hot coals all day if that's how he has to get to work, but having the plane, because other people had it would not motivate him at all. In fact, just parenthetically, since I'm a psychiatrist, I'll say it's a subtle proof that the Bible is true in that it describes in it that Moses writes of himself that he's the most modest man that ever lived. I say that because now if you think for a moment, if you were going to write a document and try to pass it off as being given over by God, and you were an honest person and you weren't lying, could you ever write of yourself or that you are the modest, most modest man that ever lived? The moment you had such a thought to write such a thing, you'd realize you can't be so modest if it even occurs to you to write such a thing. So either Moses was delusional or something, but if you assume he's a rational person, he must have been instructed by God because no one would write that himself about himself. So it's a humorous but subtle point that it would be very difficult for a normal person to write that about himself, because the moment he wrote it, he'd have to realize it wasn't true. If he had the inclination to write it. Any comments on that small? David?
No, I think we're doing all right.
All right, fine.
Okay, good.
That's a side point. Anyway, let's go back with the going out of Egypt. So the nation is born, and from a literary point of view, one can look at the splitting of the Red Sea like an amniotic sac splitting a new nation being born on the other side. As it passes through the waters, and it doesn't, as a psychiatrist, I might say, it doesn't surprise me that there's certain symbolic actions that are done that would have an impression on the unconscious. I mean, it's true they needed to get past the water to get out on a practical level, but God also may have arranged it in such a way that there's an unconscious effect on them as they pass through a narrow body of water to be born as a nation on the other side. And that purpose of their coming out is finds its culmination at Sinai with the Decalogue. Now, the Decalogue itself, I don't know if Rabbi Chase discussed this, but my view of it is that the 10 ideas of the Decalogue really reflect the basic ideas of Judaism. There, Sadia Gaon takes this view, and I think the reason why the Decalogue was given, because really, in many times we refer to Judaism, there's 613 commandments, seven or more for all mankind, 613 for the children of Abraham, and why were these 10 selected out? If they're only, because generally in Jewish law we don't give any precedence to these 10 over the other 603, but rather these can be, these summarize the basic areas of all human interaction between man and God and man and man. The first five generally viewed as between man and God, and the last five between man and man. Now, if one will look at the 10th commandment, it's an interesting commandment in light of what we've been saying. And that commandment, does anyone there know offhand what that is? The 10th commandment?
Okay. Jim, you want to answer? Not right off the bat.
Okay, that's the commandment not to covet.
Not to covet. Okay.
Which is another way, based on what we're saying, is not to be jealous. It's a prohibition against jealousy. So how does this tie into the theme I've been pointing out? Is that the brothers, as they were being formed into a nation, had overcome the fratricidal impulse and been at some level been able to make amends for their deed and reconcile with their brother. But the ultimate destiny of the Jewish people, and by extension of all mankind, is summarized in the Ten Commandments. And I have to come back to why the Ten Commandments again, besides the fact that they represent the ten basic ideas of Judaism in some sense, that so all the other commandments can be somehow ideationally subsumed under them. But the Tenth Commandment, which in one way of viewing it, it's not the only way to view it, is the culmination of the commandments, is the commandment to not, is to change one's attitude, one's feelings. Now they start out, vis-a-vis God, one starts out in the first set of five with ideas, and it culminates in the way one behaves, so the fifth commandment being honoring one's mother and father, which our rabbis talk about at length as to why that's in the first five, but the other four are clearly between man and God. And the next five, which is between man and man, starts out not to murder, start out with actions and culminate with ideas and feelings. And the culmination of all of them is the Tenth Commandment, not to have jealousy. Now, my view is, in light of what we've said, is that it really reflects the pinnacle that man can aspire to achieve, is the true relationship of his position in the universe vis-a-vis God, and that reflects itself in his relationship to his fellow man. And that when he's able to have a proper relationship to God, jealousy will no longer enter the picture. Because he's a grateful creature to be able to partake and perceive the Creator. And that any benefit that is bestowed on others, he has no feeling of jealousy. His relationship is exclusive to God, and he has no expectations from that he should have something more. It's an overwhelming, constant feeling of gratitude. The Talmud tells the story of, I forget the exact story, but the point was someone who wanted to learn a certain idea, who was missing something, I forgot what it was, whether it was happiness or wealth, and they wanted to, so the rabbi said, go see Ish Gamzu, so he'll teach you about it. You could ask Rabbi Chait, or if I speak to you again, I'll try to look it up in the meantime. But the point being, Ish Gamzu was a man who had nothing. He lived in abject poverty and misery, or at least the way the modern world or any world would perceive it. But he asked him, he was told to inquire about these things, about suffering. He said, I think it was suffering now. And he said, I don't know, I've never suffered. And yet he saw him having all the external markings of suffering, but everything in his life, he said, always had the expression, Gamzu Latova. He used to always say, this too is for the good. So he was always able to frame everything that happened in his life as being to the benefit, you know, in some ways of reflecting God's greatness, and therefore he never experienced adversity. He had a stomachache, he had a headache, whatever, he lost the horse, he He saw that it was a benevolent world that God had created, and saw everything as being a reflection of ultimately God's best will for man. So then going back to the Ten Commandments, is that this is a culmination of the purpose of creation, and in the story of the Bible, that man's or the Jewish people's role, and ultimately all man's destiny, is to have that relationship with God. Let's see, I wanted to take up another point. Oh, the Decalogue. What was the why is all this included in the Decalogue? It's a side point, but important, in that the Decalogue, I suspect Rabbi Chay had spoken about it, but it was very important how it was given. It was given to the entire Jewish nation at one time, so that every person had the experience of prophecy. And this is, there are many reasons for it, one of which is so that it would be forever emblazoned in the Jewish people's minds that this was true and it wasn't made up, because the whole idea of how we know history is true or false is that such an event could not be fabricated if it hadn't happened. You could never create a story that your own ancestors, all of them, experienced philosophy, millions of them at one time, unless it really happened. People, if you would try to fabricate such a story, people would inevitably say, oh, you're making up a lie, because why didn't I hear about it? But that's a long, separate discussion that I suspect if Rabbi Chait hasn't told you, you should inquire of him. It's a fascinating discussion as to why the Decalogue occurred. But the additional point I wanted to make to that is that it was necessary that the Jews experience, so in the Decalogue, all the ideas of the Torah, so that later on, since it was God's intent that it would basically would be given by Moses, if Moses would promulgate a law, that they would say, oh, come on, you're making that one up. If they'd heard the Decalogue and the basic ideas of Judaism, and Moses said, no, this is just a detail in the keeping of Sabbath. You understand the idea of Sabbath? Yeah, oh, sure, yeah, I understand that. Well, this particular law here falls under the category of Sabbath, and it's not a new idea. So that's why I follow Sajid Gaon's approach in saying that this is all the laws of the Torah can somehow fit themselves, their ideas, into the Ten Commandments, so that the Jewish people would always have, at least those in the desert, would be able to relate any new laws as to say, to understand this was part of what they already experienced. But anyway, going back to that was just a side point. I wanted to explain the Decalogue and the importance. But the point I'm making here is that the culmination of the Decalogue is in the not to covet. So now let me see if there's any point. Is there some points I've left out? There was more I wanted to cover. Oh, I know what I wanted to cover, which is, a detail, but let me see. Stop here for a moment and see where everyone's holding, and then I'll go back to something else.
All right, we're still with you there.
Okay.
All right.
I wanted to go into some. I kind of sketched out the basic idea, but I wanted to go into a little more detail about how Providence had arranged it in the last four sections of the first book, in the last four sections describing Jacob's children and their descent to Egypt and the conflict between the brothers and its eventual resolution. And in that story, we really see there was three groups. There is Jacob, there is the 11 brothers, and then there's Joseph. Now, Jacob, if we had to try to describe a problem that he may have had, it was that he showed a certain overattachment to Rachel, and then to his, by extension, to her two children, Joseph and Benjamin. This is a very interesting question that I'm not taking up now. Why Jacob developed that special love for Rachel initially upon sight? What did he see in her, and what did he see in Joseph that made that tremendous attachment to him? That's a very interesting point. But he did have it. And, he gave special favors, and of course he had his own, the Talmud describes why he gave him that special favors. He was brilliant, Joseph, and he had many leadership qualities, and he was grooming him to be the next leader. But whatever it was, there was an emotional element in there that was, if I'm correct in understanding the last four sections, was that Jacob, to reach his own perfection, he had to deal with. Joseph, the Bible is very careful in describing him as being, initially, as being a nar, childish, and the Midrash says that he would comb his hair and look in the mirror. And of course, even the way he describes telling about his brothers, as brilliant as he was somewhat insensitive. in telling over the dreams and bringing back reports about his brothers. And finally, the brothers themselves, who commit the act of throwing him in the pit, or trying to kill him and then throwing him in the pit and then selling him, couldn't tolerate Joseph's superior position. Now, what happens in these last four sections is that Jacob, for instance, at the end, when he's reunited with Joseph, it says he falls on his shoulder and he cries. And it doesn't say who cries. So the sages are very careful to point out that it was Joseph who cried, who had been separated from his father for as many years as Jacob himself had been separated from Isaac. And they say that Jacob, at that moment, said the sentence, Shema Yisrael, which is Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, Hashem Echad, that Hear, O Israel, Lord is our God, the Lord is one. And the idea being is that that specific love that he had for his child of Joseph became redirected towards God. He understood how God had directed him through all the difficulty. And again, his difficulty in giving up Benjamin was that he finally agreed to give up Benjamin, which was the beginning of the turning point, where he finally accepted that his wish for how things should work out for him, he had to relinquish in face of God's divine providence and accept that there was some message for some learning for him in all of that. And that's finally reflected when he reunited with Joseph, and the love he felt for his son was now redirected toward God in the statement of the Lord is one. The brothers, we see that when the troubles befall them in Egypt, the sages say that they'd gone down anyway to redeem Joseph. But when they saw the troubles that befell them there, it's stated explicitly in the Bible that that they all realized that they had sinned, and that it was because of how they'd heard their brothers crying and had not shown compassion. So they too, and in that whole story tells about how Joseph reenacts the situation. They have a similar situation where now Shimon is thrown in jail, and he frames Benjamin and says he hides the goblet in his bag. And the brothers, if they were feeling jealous towards Joseph, they would have also felt jealous towards Benjamin, who was not allowed to leave for all those years and all the troubles they'd had because Jacob would not allow Benjamin to leave. That's why Shimon had gotten himself into the who's cow. And moreover, he'd gotten special treatment in front of this father-like figure of Joseph, who was like Paro in the most powerful country in the world at the time. So Joseph in every way had tried to set up the situation to recapitulate the original crime, because he understood in the dreams that was one part of his role, was to bring the brothers to recreate a family unit in harmony. So he felt instructed by the prophecy of the dreams that allowed him to put his brothers through this ordeal. And they come through the ordeal also, in that they demonstrate their brotherly affection for Benjamin, and they don't desert him, when it would have been even easier to do so in this situation where the frame was up and they were being passive. They didn't even have to be active and sell Benjamin into slavery. All they had to do is Joseph wanted to let him go back free. He says, no, I don't want to do anything to you guys. You go back free and Benjamin will stay here. He's the only one who stole. And they refused to allow that, and they demonstrated solidarity with Benjamin, reflecting their repentance and brotherly love. And finally, Joseph, who initially starts out as being very immature, and even to the extent that he has a situation with Potiphar, he gets thrown into the jail also. He's done some improvement, but he's not quite perfectly worked out yet either. He must have given some nuance or innuendo, even though he resists the temptation there, but there's something, he was too involved with his own good looks such that she was so noticing him. And even when he's ready to be pulled out of the jail, when he interprets the dreams of the butler, the two butlers, the wine steward and the butler, he says right afterwards, oh, I'm a poor chap, please remember me to Paro, take pity on me. And he winds himself, he still spends another 2 years in jail. again, I would say there was a certain providence that he shouldn't come out of the jail, because this kind of childish dependency was not his destiny that God wanted him to have to be able to help about bringing about the reconciliation. So when he's finally pulled out of jail, he tells nothing to Paro about his sad sob story. Like, woe is me that I'm so special and so hurt that if something bad should happen to me. He's accepted his fate, and with dignity he goes about bringing about the restitution of the family, only to do God's will. And finally, at the end, to reconfirm this point, when the brothers come to him after Jacob has died, and they said they make up a story so that that they were frightened that maybe Joseph still had ill feelings for them because Jacob had just died and he was separated from his father, who he loved so much for all those years, and he might have blamed them for his separation. And you can imagine when you lose a loved one and you think about someone who had denied you access to him for most of your life, you might feel angry towards them. Yet he spoke to them and said, no, it's not true. You meant ill towards me, but it was God's providence that directed me down here, and I see myself as being a servant of God in all that I've done. And having reached that highest philosophical plane where he doesn't take it on the personal level, he's able to achieve the reunification of the brothers and the family, which, as I spoke before, is the basic idea of the first book, is to tell the story about the fall of man, which is detailed in the story of Cain and Abel and continues on through the period of the flood and then the Tower of Babel, until one man, Abraham, is, through intellectual effort and perfection of his traits, able to reach the level that God recognizes him as being a person that can lead about to the restoration of man's greatness, vis-a-vis greatness. Man's greatness, is in, as I said before, is in his humility and his ability to perceive God and live a life in accordance with that knowledge. I'm going to stop here because it's the basic ideas I had, and maybe there's some questions before we run out of time and that you might want to have answered, or I can find other things to talk about, but that's the basic overview I wanted to give about a structure.
Okay, I think you did well, and there's no questions. When you asked for them, we had head shakes, no verbal acknowledgments, but it was a good lesson. We appreciate it.
All right.
And then you can get in and finish your dinner now.
All right, I appreciate that. I wish you well. Anyone's ever up in New York, glad to talk to anyone around.
All right, take care. We certainly appreciate it, Michael.
Have a good night.
Good night. Bye-bye.